at the 30 days' end? For all the dove's eyes they've made at one another, was there ever such a glance between them as well-proved comrades exchange in farewell, when they ride different ways and both into desperate danger? I have known, I have had, so much of him that she could never dream of. She's his toy, his recreation, his leisure, his solace. I'm in his man's life. It's strange to think how Bardier went to and fro daily between queen and wife, well assured he did his duty by both, as he did, and without a thought doubtless of the pother he made between them. This is what it is to be a man. The one sin the gods never forgive us is that of being born women. The duty of queenship that irked me most was going often to the house of Ungit and sacrificing. It would have been worse, but that Ungit herself, or my pride made me think so, was now weakened. Arnhem had opened new windows in the walls, and our house was not so dark. He also kept it differently, scouring away the blood after each slaughter, and sprinkling fresh water. It smelled cleaner and less holy. And Arnhem was learning from the fox to talk like a philosopher about the gods. The great change came when he proposed to set up an image of her, a woman-shaped image in the Greek fashion, in front of the old shapeless stone. I think he would like to have got rid of the stone altogether, but it is, in a manner, Ungit herself, and the people would have gone mad if she were moved. It was a prodigious charge to get such an image as he wanted, for no one in Gloam could make it. It had to be brought, not indeed from the Greek lands themselves, but from lands where men had learned of the Greeks. I was rich now, and helped him with silver. I was not quite certain why I did this. I think I felt that an image of this sort would be somehow a defeat for the old, hungry, faceless Ungit, whose terror had been over me in childhood. The new image, when at last it came, seemed to us barbarians wonderfully beautiful and lifelike, even when we brought her white and naked into our house. And when we had painted her and put her robes on, she was a marvel to all the lands about, and pilgrims came to see her. The fox, who had seen greater and more beautiful works at home, laughed at her. I gave up trying to find a room where I should not hear that noise, which was sometimes chains swinging in the wind, and sometimes lost and beggared Psyche weeping at my door. Instead, I built stone walls round the well and put a thatched roof over it and added a door. The walls were very thick. My mason told me they were madly thick. "You're wasting enough good stone, Queen," he said, "to have made 10 new pigsties." For a while after that, an ugly fancy used to come to me in my dreams, or between sleeping and waking, that I had walled up, gagged with stone, not a well, but Psyche or Orwell herself. But that also passed. I heard Psyche weeping no more. The year after that I defeated Esur. The fox was growing old now and needed rest. We had him less and less in my pillar room. He was very busy writing a history of Gloam. He wrote it twice, in Greek and in our own tongue, which he now saw was capable of eloquence. It was strange for me to see our own speech written out in the Greek letters. I never told the fox that he knew less of it than he believed, so that what he wrote in it was often laughable, and most so where he thought it most eloquent. As he grew older, he seemed to be ever less and less a philosopher, and to talk more of eloquence and figures and poetry. His voice grew always shriller, and he talked more and more. He often mistook me for Psyche now. Sometimes he called me Crethys, and sometimes even by boys' names like Charmides or Glaucon. But I was too busy to be with him much. What did I not do? I had all the laws revised and cut in stone in the centre of the city. I narrowed and deepened the Shenet till barges could come up to our gates. I made a bridge where the old ford had been. I made cisterns so that we should not go thirsty whenever there was a dry year. I became wise about stock and bought in good bulls and rams and bettered our breeds. I did, and I did, and I did, and what does it matter what I did? I cared for all these things only as a man cares for a hunt or a game, which fills the mind and seems of some moment while it lasts. But then the beast's killed or the king's mated, and now who cares? It was so with me almost every evening of my life. One little stairway led me from feast or council, all the bustle and skill and glory of queenship, to my own chamber to be alone with myself, that is, with a nothingness. Going to bed and waking in the morning, I woke most often too early, were bad times, so many hundreds of evenings and mornings. Sometimes I wondered who or what sends us this senseless repetition of days and nights and seasons and years. Is it not like hearing a stupid boy whistle the same tune over and over till you wonder how he can bear it himself? The fox died, and I gave him a kingly funeral, and made 4 Greek verses which were cut on his tomb. I will not write them here, lest a true Greek should laugh at them. This happened about the end of harvest. The tomb is up behind the pear trees where he used to teach Psyche and me in summer. Then the days and months and years went on again as before, round and round like a wheel, till there came a day when I looked about me at the gardens and the palace and the ridge of the grey mountain out eastward, and thought I could no longer endure to see these same things every day till I died. The very blisters of the pitch on the wooden walls of the byres seemed to be the same ones I'd seen before the fox himself came to gloam. I resolved to go on a progress and travel in other lands. We were at peace with everyone. Bardia and Penuan and Arnam could do all that was needed while I was away, for indeed Gloam had now been nursed and trained till it almost ruled itself. I took with me Bardia's son Ilerdia, and Pubi's daughter Alit, and 2 of my women, and a plump of spears, all honest men, and a cook and a groom, with pack animals for the tents and victual, and rode out of Gloam 3 days later. Chapter 21 The thing for whose sake I tell this journey happened at the very end of it, and even when I had thought it was finished. We had gone first into Fars, where they harvest later than we, so that it was like having that piece of the year twice over. We found what we had just left at home, the sound of the whetting, the singing of the reapers, the flats of stubble widening, and the squares of standing corn diminishing, the piled wagons in the lanes, all the sweat and sunburn and merriment. We had lain 10 nights or more in Trunia's palace, where I was astonished to see how Redival had grown fat and lost her beauty. She talked, as of old, everlastingly, but all about her children, and asked after no one in Gloam except Butter. Trunia never listened to a word she said, but he and I had much talk together. I had already settled with my council that his second son Daran was to be king of Gloam after my day. This Daran was, for the son of so silly a mother, a right-minded boy. I could have loved him if I'd let myself, and if Redival had been out of the way. But I would never give my heart again to any young creature. Out of Fars we had turned westward into Essur by deep passes through the mountains. This was a country of forests greater than I had yet seen, and rushing rivers, with great plenty of birds, deer, and other game. The people I had with me were all young and took great pleasure in their travels, and the journey itself had by now linked us all together, all burned brown and with a world of hopes, cares, jests, and knowledge, all sprung up since we left home and shared among us. At first they had been in awe of me and had ridden in silence. Now we were good friends, my own heart lifted, the eagles wheeled above us and the waterfalls roared. From the mountains we came down into Essur and lay 3 nights in the king's house. He was, I think, not a bad sort of man, but too slavish courteous to me, for Gloam and Fars in alliance had made Essur change her tune. His queen was manifestly terrified by my veil and by the story she'd heard of me. And from that house I had meant to turn homewards, but we were told of a natural hot spring 15 miles further to the west. I knew Ilerdia longed to see it, and I thought, between sadness and smiling, how the fox would have scolded me if I'd been so near any curious work of nature and not examined it. So I said we would go the day's journey further and turn then. It was the calmest day, pure autumn, very hot, yet the sunlight on the stubble looked aged and gentle, not fierce like the summer heats. You would think the year was resting, its work done. And I whispered to myself that I too would begin to rest. When I was back at Glome, I would no longer pile task on task. I would let Bardia rest, too. I'd often thought he had begun to look tired. And we would let younger heads be busy, while we sat in the sun and talked of our old battles. What more was there for me to do? Why should I not be at peace? I thought this was the wisdom of old age beginning. The hot spring, like all such rarities, was only food for stupid wonder. When we had seen it, we went further down the warm green valley in which it rose, and found a good camping place between a stream and a wood. While my people were busied with the tents and the horses, I went a little way into the wood and sat there in the coolness. Before long, I heard the ringing of a temple bell. All temples nearly have bells in Essor, from somewhere behind me. Thinking it would be pleasant to walk a little after so many hours on horseback, I rose and went slowly through the trees to find the temple, very idly, not caring whether I found it or not. But in a few minutes I came out into a mossy place free of trees, and there it was, no bigger than a peasant's hut, but built of pure white stone with fluted pillars in the Greek style. Behind it I could see a small thatched house where no doubt the priest lived. The place itself was quiet enough, but inside the temple there was a far deeper silence, and it was very cool. It was clean and empty, and there were none of the common temple smells about it, so that I thought it must belong to one of those small, peaceful gods who are content with flowers and fruit for sacrifice. Then I saw it must be a goddess, for there was on the altar the image of a woman, about 2 feet high, carved in wood, not badly done, and all the fairer to my mind because there was no painting or gilding, but only the natural, pale colour of the wood. The thing that marred it was a band or scarf of some black stuff tied round the head of the image so as to hide its face, much like my own veil, but that mine was white. I thought how much better all this was than the house of Ungit, and how unlike. Then I heard a step behind me, and turning, saw that a man in a black robe had come in. He was an old man with quiet eyes, perhaps a little simple. "Does the stranger want to make an offering to the goddess?" he asked. I slipped a couple of coins into his hand and asked what goddess she was. "Istra," he said. The name is not so uncommon in Glome and the neighbouring lands that I had much cause to be startled, but I said I'd never heard of a goddess called that. "Oh, that is because she's a very young goddess. She's only just begun to be a goddess. For you must know that, like many other gods, she began by being a mortal." "And how was she godded?" "She's so lately godded that she's still a rather poor goddess, stranger. Yet for one little silver piece I will tell you the sacred story." "Thank you, kind stranger, thank you. Istra will be your friend for this. Now I will tell you the sacred story. Once upon a time in a certain land there lived a king and a queen who had 3 daughters, and the youngest was the most beautiful princess in the whole world." And so he went on, as such priests do, all in a sing-song voice and using words which he clearly knew by heart. And to me it was as if the old man's voice, and the temple, and I myself, and my journey were all things in such a story. For he was telling the very history of our Istra, of Psyche herself. How Talapal, that's the Assyrian Ungit, was jealous of her beauty and made her to be offered to a brute on a mountain. And how Talapal's son Ialim, the most beautiful of the gods, loved her and took her away to his secret palace. He even knew that Ialim had there visited her only in darkness and had forbidden her to see his face. But he had a childish reason for that. "You see, stranger, he had to be very secret because of his mother Talapal. She would have been very angry with him if she'd known he'd married the woman she most hated in the world." I thought to myself, it's well for me I didn't hear this story 15 years ago. Yes, or even 10. It would have reawakened all my sleeping miseries. Now it moves me hardly at all. Then, suddenly, struck afresh with the queerness of the thing, I asked him, "Where did you learn all this?" He stared at me as if he didn't well understand such a question. "It's the sacred story," he said. I saw that he was rather silly than cunning, and that it would be useless to question him. As soon as I was silent, he went on. But now all the dreamlike feeling in me suddenly vanished. I was wide awake, and I felt the blood rush into my face. He was telling it wrong, hideously and stupidly wrong. First of all, he made it that both Psyche sisters had visited her in the secret palace of the god. To think of Redival going there! "And so," he said, "when her two sisters had seen the beautiful palace and been feasted and given gifts, they saw the palace. Stranger, you are hindering the sacred story. Of course they saw the palace, they weren't blind. And then—" It was as if the gods themselves had first laughed and then spat in my face. So this was the shape the story had taken. You may say the shape the gods had given it. For it must be they who had put it into the old fool's mind, or into the mind of some other dreamer from whom he'd learned it. How could any mortal have known of that palace at all? That much of the truth they had dropped into someone's mind, in a dream or an oracle, or however they do such things. That much, and wiped clean out the very meaning, the pith, the central knot of the whole tale. Do I not do well to write a book against them, telling what they have kept hidden? Never, sitting on my judgment seat, had I caught a false witness in a more cunning half-truth. For if the true story had been like their story, no riddle would have been set me. There would have been no guessing, and no guessing wrong. More than that, it's a story belonging to a different world, a world in which the gods show themselves clearly, and don't torment men with glimpses, nor unveil to one what they hide from another, nor ask you to believe what contradicts your eyes and ears and nose and tongue and fingers. In such a world, is there such? It's not ours for certain. I would have walked aright. The gods themselves would have been able to find no fault in me. And now to tell my story as if I had had the very sight they had denied me. Is it not as if you told a cripple story and never said he was lame, or told how a man betrayed a secret but never said it was after 20 hours of torture? And I saw all in a moment how the false story would grow and spread and be told all over the earth. And I wondered how many of the other sacred stories are just such twisted falsities as this. "And so," the priest was saying, "when these two wicked sisters had made their plan to ruin Istra, they brought her the lamp and—" "But why did they, want to separate her from the god if they'd seen the palace?" "They wanted to destroy her because they had seen her palace." "But why?" "Oh, because they were jealous. Her husband and her house were so much finer than theirs." That moment I resolved to write this book. For years now my old quarrel with the gods had slept. I had come into Bardia's way of thinking. I no longer meddled with them. Often, though I had seen a god myself, I was near to believing that there are no such things. The memory of his voice and face was kept in one of those rooms of my soul that I didn't lightly unlock. Now, instantly, I knew I was facing them, I with no strength and they with all, I visible to them, they invisible to me. I easily wounded, already so wounded that all my life had been but a hiding and staunching of the wound, they invulnerable. I one, they many. In all these years they'd only let me run away from them as far as the cat lets the mouse run. Now, snatch, and the claw on me again. Well, I could speak, I could set down the truth. What had never perhaps been done in the world before should be done now. The case against them should be written. Jealousy! I, jealous of Psyche! I sickened not only at the vileness of the lie, but at its flatness. It seemed as if the gods had minds just like the lowest of the people. What came easiest to them, what seemed the likeliest and simplest reason to put in a story, was the dull, narrow passion of the beggars' streets, the temple brothels, the slave, the child, the dog. Could they not lie, if lie they must, better than that? "And wanders over the earth, weeping, weeping, always weeping." How long had the old man been going on? That one word rang in my ears as if he had repeated it 1,000 times. I set my teeth and my soul stood on guard. A moment more and I should have begun to hear the sound myself again. She would have been weeping in that little wood outside the temple door. "That's enough!" I shouted. "Do you think I don't know a girl cries when her heart breaks? Go on, go on!"
"Wanders weeping, weeping, always weeping," he said, "and falls under the power of Tullapal, who hates her.
And, of course, Ialim can't protect her because Tullapal is his mother and he's afraid of her. So Tullapal torments Istra and sets her to all manner of hard labours, things that seem impossible. But when Istra has done them all, then at last Tullapal releases her and she is reunited to Ialim and becomes a goddess. Then we take off her black veil, and I change my black robe for a white one, and we offer...
You mean she will someday be reunited to the god, and you will take off her veil then? When is this to happen?
We take off the veil, and I change my robe in the spring.
Do you think I care what you do? Has the thing itself happened yet or not? Is Istra now wandering over the earth, or has she already become a goddess?
But, stranger, the sacred story is about the sacred things, the things we do in the temple. In spring and all summer she is a goddess. Then when harvest comes we bring a lamp into the temple in the night, and the god flies away. Then we veil her. And all winter she is wandering and suffering, weeping, always weeping.
He knew nothing. The story and the worship were all one in his mind. He could not understand what I was asking.
"I've heard your story told otherwise, old man," said I. "I think the sister, or the sisters, might have more to say for themselves than you know."
"You may be sure that they would have plenty to say for themselves," he replied. "The jealous always have. Why, my own wife now!"
I saluted him and went out of that cold place into the warmth of the wood. I could see through the trees the red light of the fire my people had already kindled. The sun had set. I hid all the things I was feeling, and indeed I did not know what they were except that all the peace of that autumnal journey was shattered, so as not to spoil the pleasure of my people. Next day I understood more clearly. I could never be at peace again till I had written my charge against the gods. It burned me from within. It quickened. I was with book as a woman is with child. And so it comes about that I can tell nothing of our journey back to Gloam. There were 7 or 8 days of it, and we passed many notable places in Assur. And in Gloam, after we had crossed the border, we saw everywhere such good peace and plenty and such duty, and I think love towards myself, as ought to have gladdened me. But my eyes and ears were shut up. All day, and often all night too, I was recalling every passage of the true story, dragging up terrors, humiliations, struggles, and anguish that I'd not thought of for years, letting Orawal wake and speak, digging her almost out of a grave, out of the walled well. The more I remembered, the more still I could remember, often weeping beneath my veil as if I had never been queen, yet never in so much sorrow that my burning indignation did not rise above it. I was in haste, too. I must write it all quickly before the gods found some way to silence me. Whenever, towards evening, Ilerdia pointed and said, "Their queen will be a good place for the tents," I said, before I had thought what I would say, "No, no, we can make 3 more miles tonight, or 5. Every morning I woke earlier. At first I endured the waiting, fretting myself in the cold mist, listening to the deep-breathed sleep of those young sleepers. But soon my patience would serve me no longer. I took to waking them. I woke them earlier each morning. In the end we were travelling like those who fly from a victorious enemy. I became silent, and this struck the others silent too. I could see they were bewildered, and all the comfort of their travels was gone. I suppose they whispered together about the Queen's moods. When I reached home, even then I could not set about it as suddenly as I had hoped, all manner of petty work had piled up. And now, when I most needed help, word was sent me that Bardia was a little sick and kept his bed. I asked Arnhem about Bardia's sickness, and Arnhem said, "It's neither poison nor fever, Queen. A small matter for a strong man. But he'd best not rise. He's aging, you know." It would have given me a thrust of fear, but that I already knew, and had seen growing signs of it lately, how that wife of his cockered and cosseted him like a hen with one chicken. Not, I'd swear, through any true fears, but to keep him at home and away from the palace. Yet, at last, after infinite hindrances, I made my book, and here it stands. Now, you who read, judge between the gods and me. They gave me nothing in the world to love but Psyche, and then took her from me. But that was not enough. They then brought me to her at such a place and time that it hung on my word whether she should continue in bliss or be cast out into misery. They would not tell me whether she was the bride of a god, or mad, or a brute's or villain's spoil. They would give no clear sign, though I begged for it. I had to guess. And because I guessed wrong, they punished me. What's worse, punished me through her. And even that was not enough. They have now sent out a lying story in which I was given no riddle to guess, but knew and saw that she was the god's bride, and of my own will destroyed her, and that for jealousy. As if I were another Redivale. I say the gods deal very unrightly with us, for they will neither, which would be best of all, go away and leave us to live our own short days to ourselves, nor will they show themselves openly and tell us what they would have us do, for that too would be endurable. But to hint and hover, to draw near us in dreams and oracles, or in a waking vision that vanishes as soon as seen, to be dead silent when we question them and then glide back and whisper words we cannot understand in our ears when we most wish to be free of them, and to show to one what they hide from another, what is all this but cat-and-mouse play, blind man's buff and mere jugglery? Why must holy places be dark places? I say, therefore, that there is no creature, toad, scorpion, or serpent, so noxious to man as the gods. Let them answer my charge if they can. It may well be that instead of answering, they'll strike me mad or leprous, or turn me into beast, bird, or tree. But will not all the world then know, and the gods will know it knows, that this is because they have no answer? Book 2, Chapter 1. Not many days have passed since I wrote those words, "No answer," but I must unroll my book again. It would be better to rewrite it from the beginning, but I think there's no time for that. Weakness comes on me fast, and Arnhem shakes his head and tells me I must rest. They think, I don't know, they have sent a message to Darren. Since I cannot mend the book, I must add to it. To leave it as it was would be to die perjured. I know so much more than I did about the woman who wrote it. What began the change was the very writing itself. Let no one lightly set about such a work. Memory, once waked, will play the tyrant. I found I must set down, for I was speaking as before judges and must not lie, passions and thoughts of my own which I had clean forgotten. The past which I wrote down was not the past that I thought I had all these years been remembering. I did not, even when I had finished the book, see clearly many things that I see now. The change which the writing wrought in me, and of which I did not write, was only a beginning, only to prepare me for the god's surgery. They used my own pen to probe my wound. Very early in the writing there also came a stroke from without. While I related my first years, when I wrote how Redivale and I built mud houses in the garden, a thousand other things came back into my mind, all about those days when there was no Psyche and no fox, only I and Redivale, catching tadpoles in the brook, hiding from butter in the hay, waiting at the door of the hall when our father gave a feast and wheedling tidbits out of the slaves as they went in and out. And I thought how terribly she changed, this all within my own mind. But then the stroke from without. On top of many other hindrances came word of an embassy from the great king who lives to the south and east. Another plague, said I. And when the strangers came, and there must be hours of talk and a feast for them afterwards, I liked them none the better for finding that their chief man was a eunuch. Eunuchs are very great men at that court. This one was the fattest man I ever saw, so fat his eyes could hardly see over his cheeks, all shining and reeking with oil, and tricked out with as much doll finery as one of Ungit's girls. But as he talked and talked, I began to think there was a faint likeness in him to someone I had seen long ago. And as we do, I chased it and gave it up, and chased it and gave it up again, till suddenly, when I least thought of it, the truth started into my mind, and I shouted out, "Tarin!" "Oh, yes, Queen, oh, yes," said he, spiteful, pleased, I thought, and leering. "Oh, yes, I was him you called Tarin. Your father did not love me, Queen, did he? But he made my fortune. Oh, yes, he set me on the right road, with two cuts of a razor. But for him I should not have been the great man I am now." I wished him joy of his advancement. "Thank you, Queen, thank you, it is very good. And to think that but for your father's temper I might have gone on carrying a shield in the guard of a little barbarous king, whose whole kingdom could be put into one corner of my master's hunting park and never be noticed. You will not be angry, no?" I said I'd always heard that the great king had an admirable park. "And your sister, Queen," said the eunuch. "Oh, she was a pretty little girl, though. I've had finer women through my hands since. Is she still alive?" "She is the Queen of Fars," said I. "Ah, so, Fars, I remember. One forgets the names of all these little countries. Yes, a pretty little girl. I took pity on her. She was lonely." "Lonely," said I. "Oh, yes, yes, very lonely. After the other princess, the baby, came, she used to say, 'First of all, Orowa loved me much. Then the fox came, and she loved me little. Then the baby came, and she loved me not at all.' So she was lonely. I was sorry for her. Oh, I was a fine young fellow then. Half the girls in Gloam were in love with me." I led him back to our affairs of state. This was only the first stroke, a light one, the first snowflake of the winter that I was entering, regarded only because it tells us what's to come. I was by no means sure that Tarin spoke truly. I'm sure still that Redivar was false and a fool. And for her folly the gods themselves cannot blame me. She had that from her father. But one thing was certain. I had never thought at all how it might be with her when I turned first to the fox and then to Psyche. For it had been somehow settled in my mind from the very beginning that I was the pitiable and ill-used one. She had her gold curls, hadn't she? So back to my writing. And the continual labour of mind to which it put me began to overflow into my sleep. It was a labour of sifting and sorting, separating motive from motive and both from pretext. And this same sorting went on every night in my dreams, but in a changed fashion. I thought I had before me a huge, hopeless pile of seeds, wheat, barley, poppy, rye, millet, what not, and I must sort them out and make separate piles, each all of one kind. Why I must do it I did not know, but infinite punishment would fall upon me if I rested a moment from my labour, or if, when all was done, a single seed were in the wrong pile. In waking life a man would know the task impossible. The torment of the dream was that there it could conceivably be done. There was one chance in 10,000 of finishing the labour in time, and one in 100,000 of making no mistake. It was all but certain I should fail and be punished, but not certain. And so to it, searching, peering, picking up each seed between finger and thumb. Yet not always finger and thumb, for in some dreams, more madly still, I became a little ant, and the seeds were as big as millstones, and labouring with all my might till my six legs cracked, I carried them to their places, holding them in front of me as ants do, loads bigger than myself. One thing that shows how wholly the gods kept me to my two labours, the days and the nights, is that all this time I hardly gave Bardia a thought, save to grumble at his absence because it meant that I was more hindered in my writing. While the rage of it lasted, nothing seemed to matter a straw except finishing my book. Of Bardia I only said once and again, "Does he mean to slug abed for the rest of his life, or it's that wife of his? Then there came a day when that last line of the book, "They have no answer," was still wet. And I found myself listening to Arnhem and understanding, as if for the first time, what his looks and voice meant. "Do you mean I cried that the Lord Bardia is in danger?" "He's very weak, Queen," said the priest. "I wish the fox were with us. We are bunglers, we of Gloam. It seems to me that Bardia has no strength or spirit to fight the sickness."
"Good God," said I, "why did you not make me understand this before? Oh, slave, my horse, I will go and see him."
Arnhem was an old and trusted counsellor now. He laid his hand on my arm. "Queen," he said gently and very gravely, "it would make him the less likely to recover if you now went to him."
"Do I carry such an infection about me?" said I. "Is there death in my aspect even through a veil?"
"Bardia is your most loyal and most loving subject," said Arnhem. "To see you would call up all his powers, perhaps crack them. He'd rouse himself to his duty and courtesy. 100 affairs of state on which he meant to speak to you would crowd into his mind. He'd rack his brains to remember things he has forgotten for these last 9 days. It might kill him. Leave him to drowse and dream. It's his best chance now." It was as bitter a truth as I'd ever tasted, but I drank it. Would I not have crouched silent in my own dungeons? As long as Arnhem bade me, it would add one featherweight to Bardia's chance of life. 3 days I bore it. I, the old fool with hanging dugs and shrivelled flanks. On the fourth I said, "I can bear it no longer." On the fifth, Arnhem came to me, himself weeping, and I knew his tidings without words. And this is a strange folly, that what seemed to me worst of all was that Bardia had died without ever hearing what it would have shamed him to hear. It seemed to me that all would be bearable if once only I could have gone to him and whispered in his ear, "Bardia, I loved you." When they laid him on the pyre, I could only stand by to honour him, because I was neither his wife nor kin. I might not wail nor beat the breast for him. Ah, if I could have beaten the breast, I would have put on steel gloves or hedgehog skins to do it. I waited 3 days, as the custom is, and then went to comfort, so they call it, his widow. It was not only duty and usage that drove me. Because he had loved her, she was, in a way, surely enough the enemy. Yet who else in the whole world could now talk to me? They brought me into the upper room in her house, where she sat at her spinning, very pale but very calm, calmer than I. Once I had been surprised that she was so much less beautiful than report had made her. Now, in her later years, she had won a new kind of beauty. It was a proud, still sort of face. "Lady Ansett," I said, taking both her hands. She had not time to get them away from me. "What shall I say to you? How can I speak of him and not say that your loss is indeed without measure? And that's no comfort, unless you can think even now that it is better to have had and lost such a husband than to enjoy any man else in the world for ever." "The Queen does me great honour," said Ansett, pulling her hands out of mine so as to stand with them crossed on her breast, her eyes cast down in the court fashion. "Oh, dear lady, unqueen me a little, I beseech you. Is it as if you and I had never met till yesterday? After yours, never think I'd compare them, my loss is greatest. I pray you your seat again and your distaff. We shall talk better to that movement, and you will let me sit here beside you?" She sat down and resumed her spinning, her face at rest and her lips a little pursed, very housewifely. She would give me no help. "It was very unlooked for," said I. "Did you at first see any danger in this sickness?"
"Yes."
"Did you so? To me, Arnhem said it ought to have been a light matter."
"He said that to me, Queen. He said it would be a light matter for a man who had all his strength to fight it."
"Strength? But the Lord Bardia was a strong man."
"Yes, as a tree that is eaten away within."
"Eaten away? And with what? I never knew this."
"I suppose not, Queen. He was tired. He had worked himself out, or been worked. 10 years ago he should have given over and lived as old men do. He was not made of iron or brass, but flesh."
He never looked nor spoke like an old man. Perhaps you never saw him, Queen, at the times when a man shows his weariness. You never saw his haggard face in early morning, nor heard his groan when you, because you had sworn to do it, must shake him and force him to rise. You never saw him come home late from the palace, hungry yet too tired to eat. How should you, Queen? I was only his wife. He was too well mannered, you know, to nod and yawn in a queen's house. You mean that his work? 5 wars? 31 battles? 19 embassies? Taking thought for this and thought for that? Speaking a word in one ear and another, soothing this man and scaring that and flattering a third? Devising, consulting, remembering, guessing, forecasting? And the pillar room, and the pillar room. The mines are not the only place where a man can be worked to death. This was worse than the worst I had looked for. A flash of anger passed through me, then a horror of misgiving. Could it, but that was fantastical, be true? But the misery of that mere suspicion made my own voice almost humble. You speak in your sorrow, lady, but forgive me, this is mere fantasy. I never spared myself more than him. Do you tell me a strong man would break under the burden a woman's bearing still? Who that knows men would doubt it? They are harder, but we are tougher. They do not live longer than we. They do not weather a sickness better. Men are brittle. And you, Queen, weather younger. My heart shriveled up, cold and abject within me. If this is true, said I, I've been deceived. If he had dropped but a word of it, I'd have taken every burden from him, sent him home forever, loaded with every honour I could give. You know him little, Queen, if you think he'd ever have spoken that word. Oh, you have been a fortunate queen. No prince ever had more loving servants. I know I've had loving servants. Do you grudge me that? Even now in your grief, will your heart serve you to grudge me that? Do you mock me, because that is the only sort of love I ever had or could have? No husband, no child. And you, you who've had it all? All you left me, Queen. Left you? Fool, what mad thought is in your mind? Oh, I know well enough that you were not lovers. You left me that. The divine blood will not mix with subjects, they say. You left me my share. When you had used him, you'd let him steal home to me until you needed him again. After weeks and months at the wars, you and he night and day together, sharing the counsels, the dangers, the victories, the soldiers' bread, the very jokes, he could come back to me. Each time a little thinner and greyer, and with a few more scars, and fall asleep before his supper was down, and cry out in his dream, "Quick, on the right there, the Queen's in danger!" And next morning, the Queen's a wonderful early riser in Gloam, the pillar room again. I'll not deny it, I had what you left of him. Her look and voice now were such as no woman could mistake. "What?" I cried. "Is it possible you're jealous?" She said nothing. I sprang to my feet and pulled aside my veil. "Look, look, you fool," I cried. "Are you jealous of this?" She started back from me, gazing, so that for a moment I wondered if my face were a terror to her. But it was not fear that moved her. For the first time that prim mouth of hers twitched. The tears began to gather in her eyes. "Oh," she gasped. "Oh, I never knew. You also."
"What?"
"You loved him. You've suffered too. We both—" She was weeping, and I. Next moment we were in each other's arms. It was the strangest thing that our hatred should die out at the very moment she first knew her husband was the man I loved. It would have been far otherwise if he were still alive. But on that desolate island, our blank, unbodied life, we were the only two castaways. We spoke a language, so to call it, which no one else in the huge, heedless world could understand. Yet it was a language only of sobs. We could not even begin to speak of him in words. That would have unsheathed both daggers at once. The softness did not last. I've seen something like this happen in a battle. A man was coming at me, I at him, to kill. Then came a sudden great gust of wind that wrapped our cloaks over our swords and almost over our eyes, so that we could do nothing to one another but must fight the wind itself. And that ridiculous contention, so foreign to the business we were on, set us both laughing, face to face, friends for a moment, and then at once enemies again and forever. So here. Presently, I have no memory how it came about, we were apart again. I now resuming my veil, her face hard and cold. "Well," I was saying, "you have made me little better than the Lord Bardia's murderer. It was your aim to torture me, and you chose your torture well. Be content, you're avenged. But tell me this, did you speak only to wound, or did you believe what you said?"
"Believe? I do not believe. I know that your queenship drank up his blood year by year and ate out his life."
"Then why did you not tell me? A word from you would have sufficed. Or are you like the gods who will speak only when it is too late?"
"Tell you?" she said, looking at me with a sort of proud wonder. "Tell you? And so take away from him his work, which was his life, for what's any woman to a man and a soldier in the end, and all his glory and his great deeds? Make a child and a dotard of him, keep him to myself at that cost, make him so mine that he was no longer his?"
"And yet he would have been yours."
"But I would be his. I was his wife, not his doxy. He was my husband, not my house-dog. He was to live the life he thought best and fittest for a great man, not that which would most pleasure me. You've taken Elerdia now, too. He will turn his back on his mother's house more and more. He will seek strange lands and be occupied with matters I don't understand, and go where I can't follow and be daily less mine, more his own and the world's. Do you think I'd lift up my little finger if lifting it would stop it?
And you could, and you can, bear that?
You ask that? Oh, Queen Orwell, I begin to think you know nothing of love. Oh, no, I'll not say that. Yours is Queen's love, not commoners. Perhaps you who spring from the gods love like the gods, like the shadow brute. They say the loving and the devouring are all one, don't they?"
"Woman," said I saved his life." "Thankless fool, you'd have been widowed many a year sooner if I'd not been there one day on the field of Ingarn, and got that wound which still aches at every change of weather. Where are your scars?"
"Where a woman's are when she has borne 8 children. Yes, saved his life. Why, you had use for it. Thrift, Queen Orwell, too good a sword to throw away. Ha! You're full-fed, gorged with other men's lives, women's too. Bardia's mine, the fox's, your sister's, both your sisters."
"It's enough," I cried.
The air in her room was shot with crimson. It came horribly in my mind that if I ordered her to torture and death, no one could save her. Arnhem would murmur, Elerdia would turn rebel, but she'd be twisting cockchafer-like on a sharp stake before anyone could help her. Something, if it was the gods I blessed their name, made me unable to do this. I got somehow to the door. Then I turned and said to her,
"If you had spoken thus to my father, he'd have had your tongue cut out."
"What, afraid of it?" said she. As I rode homeward, I said to myself, "She shall have her Elerdia back. He can go and live on his lands, turn oaf, grow fat and mumble between his belches about the price of bullocks. I would have made him a great man. Now he shall be nothing. He may thank his mother. She'll not have need to say again that I devour her menfolk." But I did none of these things to Elerdia. And now those divine surgeons had me tied down and were at work. My anger protected me only for a short time. Anger wearies itself out and truth comes in. For it was all true, truer than Ansett could know. I had rejoiced when there was a press of work, had heaped up needless work to keep him late at the palace, plied him with questions for the mere pleasure of hearing his voice. Anything to put off the moment when he would go and leave me to my emptiness. And I'd hated him for going, punished him too. Men have 100 ways of mocking a man who's thought to love his wife too well, and Bardia was defenceless. Everyone knew he'd married an undowered girl, and Ansett boasted that she'd no need, like most, to seek out the ugliest girls in the slave market for her household. I never mocked him myself, but I had endless slights and contrivances behind my veil for pushing the talk in such directions as I knew would make others mock him. I hated them for doing it,
but I had a bittersweet pleasure at his clouded face. Did I hate him, then? Indeed, I believe so. A love like that can grow to be 9/10 hatred and still call itself love. One thing's certain, in my mad midnight fantasies, Ansett dead, or better still proved whore, witch, or traitress, when he was at last to be seeking my love, I always had him begin by imploring my forgiveness. Sometimes he had hard work to get it. I would bring him within an ace of killing himself first. But the result, when all those bitter hours were over, was a strange one. The craving for Bardia was ended. No one will believe this was not lived long and looked hard, so that he knows how suddenly a passion which has for years been wrapped round the whole heart will dry up and wither. Perhaps in the soul, as in the soil, those growths that show the brightest colours and put forth the most overpowering smell have not always the deepest root, or perhaps it's age that does it. But most of all, I think, it was this. My love for Bardia, not Bardia himself, had become to me a sickening thing. I had been dragged up and out onto such heights and precipices of truth that I came into an air where it could not live. It stank. A gnawing greed for one to whom I could give nothing, of whom I craved all. Heaven knows how we had tormented him, Ansett and I. For it needs no Oedipus to guess that many and many a night her jealousy of me had welcomed him home late from the palace to a bitter hearth. But when the craving went, nearly all that I called myself went with it. It was as if my whole soul had been one tooth, and now that tooth was drawn. I was a gap. And now I thought I'd come to the very bottom, and that the gods could tell me no worse. Chapter 2. A few days after I had been with Ansett came the rite of the year's birth. This is when the priest is shut up in the house of Ungit from sunset, and on the following noon fights his way out and is said to be born. But of course, like all these sacred matters, it is and it is not, so that it was easy for the fox to show its manifold contradictions. For the fight is with wooden swords, and instead of blood, wine is poured over the combatants. And though they say he is shut into the house, it's only the great door to the city and the west that is shut, and the two smaller doors at the other end are open, and common worshippers go in and out at will. When there is a king in Glome, he has to go in with the priest at sunset and remain in the house till the birth. But it is unlawful for a virgin to be present at the things which are done in the house that night, so I go in by the north door only an hour before the birth. The others who have to be there are one of the nobles and one of the elders, and one of the people, chosen in a sacred manner which I am not allowed to write. That year it was a fresh morning, very sweet, with a light wind from the south, and because of that freshness out of doors, I felt it more than ever a horrible thing to go into the dark holiness of Ungit's house. I have, I think, said before that Arnhem had made it a little lighter and cleaner, but it was still an imprisoning, smothering sort of place, and especially on the morning of the birth, when there had been censing and slaughtering and pouring of wine and pouring of blood and dancing and feasting and tousing of girls and burning of fat all night long. There was as much taint of sweat and foul air as in a mortal's house would have set the laziest slut to opening windows, scouring and sweeping. I came and sat on the flat stone, which is my place, opposite the sacred stone which is Ungit herself. The new woman-shaped image a little on my left. Arnhem's seat was on my right. He was in his mask, of course, nodding with weariness. They were beating the drums, but not loud, and otherwise there was silence. I saw the terrible girls sitting in rows down both sides of the house, each cross-legged at the door of her cell. Thus they sat, year after year, and usually barren after a few seasons, till they turned into the toothless crones who were hobbling about the floor, tending fires and sweeping. Sometimes, after a swift glance round, stooping as suddenly as a bird to pick up a coin or a half-gnawed bone and hide it in their gowns. And I thought how the seed of men that might have gone to make hardy boys and fruitful girls was drained into that house and nothing given back, and how the silver that men had earned hard and needed was also drained in there and nothing given back, and how the girls themselves were devoured and were given nothing back. Then I looked at Ungit herself. She had not, like most sacred stones, fallen from the sky. The story was that at the very beginning she had pushed her way up out of the earth, a foretaste of, or an ambassador from, whatever things may live and work down there, one below the other, all the way down under the dark and weight and heat. I have said she had no face, but that meant she had a thousand faces, for she was very uneven, lumpy and furrowed, so that, as when we gaze into a fire, you could always see some face or other. She was now more rugged than ever because of all the blood they'd poured over her in the night. In the little clots and chains of it I made out a face, a fancy at one moment, but then, once you'd seen it, not to be evaded. A face such as you might see in a loaf, swollen, brooding, infinitely female. It was a little like Bata, as I remembered her in certain of her moods. Bata, when we were very small, had her loving moods even to me. I have run out into the garden to get free, and to get, as it were, freshened and cleansed from her huge, hot, strong yet flabby, soft embraces, the smothering, engulfing tenacity of her. Yes, I thought, Ungit is very like butter today. Arnhem, said I, whispering, who is Ungit? I think, Queen, said he, his voice strange out of the mask, she signifies the earth, which is the womb and mother of all living things. This was the new way of talking about the gods, which Arnhem and others had learned from the fox. If she is the mother of all things, said I, in what way more is she the mother of the god of the mountain? He is the air and the sky, for we see the clouds coming up from the earth in mists and exhalations. Then why do the stories sometimes say he is her husband too? That means that the sky, by its showers, makes the earth fruitful. If that's all they mean, why do they wrap it up in so strange a fashion? Doubtless, said Arnhem, and I could tell that he was yawning inside the mask, being worn out with his vigil, doubtless to hide it from the vulgar. I would torment him no more, but I said to myself, it's very strange that our fathers should first think it worth telling us that rain falls out of the sky, and then, for fear such a notable secret should get out, why not hold their tongues, wrap it up in a filthy tale so that no one could understand the telling. The drums went on. My back began to ache. Presently the little door on my right opened, and a woman, a peasant, came in. You could see she'd not come for the birth feast, but on some more pressing matter of her own. She had done nothing, as even the poorest contrive for that feast, to make herself gay, and the tears were wet on her cheeks. She looked as if she'd cried all night, and in her hands she held a live pigeon. One of the lesser priests came forward at once, took the tiny offering from her, slit it open with his stone knife, splashed the little shower of blood over Ungit, where it became like dribble from the mouth of the face I saw in her, and gave the body to one of the temple slaves. The peasant woman sank down on her face at Ungit's feet. She lay there a very long time, so shaking that anyone could tell how bitterly she wept. But the weeping ceased. She rose up on her knees and put back her hair from her face and took a long breath. Then she rose to go, and as she turned I could look straight into her eyes. She was grave enough, and yet, I was very close to her and could not doubt it, it was as if a sponge had been passed over her, the trouble was soothed. She was calm, patient, able for whatever she had to do. "Has Ungit comforted you, child?" I asked. "Oh, yes, Queen," said the woman, her face almost brightening. "Oh, yes, Ungit has given me great comfort. There's no goddess like Ungit." "Do you always pray to that, Ungit?" said I, nodding toward the shapeless stone, "and not to that?" Here I nodded towards our new image, standing tall and straight in her robes, and, whatever the fox might say of it, the loveliest thing our land has ever seen. "Oh, always this queen," said she. "That other, the Greek Ungit, she wouldn't understand my speech. She's only for nobles and learned men. There's no comfort in her." Soon after that, it was noon, and the sham fight at the western door had to be done, and we all came out into the daylight after Arnhem. I had seen often enough before what met us there.